April 6, 1962, Lecture 38, The Relation of Wave and Particle Viewpoints. April 6, 1962, Lecture 38, The Relation of Wave and Particle Viewpoints. April 6, 1962, Lecture 38, The Relation of Wave and Particle Viewpoints. Lecture 38.
Talk about the relationship of the wave and particle viewpoints. We know already from last lecture that neither the wave viewpoint nor the particle viewpoint is correct. Therefore, what I'm going to say today is in a different kind of a lecture than I've been used to giving. Usually what I've been trying to do is to be very careful to tell you things accurately and such and precisely enough so that it won't have to be changed when you learn more. Maybe it'll be extended, but it won't be changed. But when I try to talk about the wave picture or the particle picture, both of which are approximate, both will change. What I am therefore saying today will not contain any accuracy in a certain sense. It's a kind of a half-intuitive kind of arguing that will be made more precise later, but that certain things will be changed a little bit in their interpretation when we interpret them correctly in the quantum mechanics. The reason for doing such a thing is, of course, that we're not going to go directly into the quantum mechanics, and I want to give you some idea of the kinds of effects. Furthermore, all our experiences are with waves and with particles, and so it is rather handy to use the wave and particle ideas to get some idea of what happens in given circumstances before you know the complete mathematics of the quantum mechanical amplitudes. So I therefore point out to you that some of the things I will say are not exactly to be interpreted precisely, ultimately, the way I say them. I'll try to illustrate the worst places as I go along. But most of it is very close to right. It's just a question of correct interpretation. To begin with, the relation, what we would like to discuss is this, that in the classical theory, we think of the thing as a particle. A particle has energy and has momentum and so on. And in the wave picture, we consider a wave which has a frequency and a wave number. And in the correct picture, we have an amplitude which varies for different circumstances. Now, if we have a single particle, which is to go from one place to another, the amplitude to arrive at different places and at different times varies with the position and the time. How does it vary? Well, it's complicated, and it's given by a set of complicated equations, which you learn when you learn the quantum mechanics. The Schrödinger equation, for example, if the particle corresponds to non-relativistic energies, the Dirac equation, if it's an electron at relativistic or other energies, the Maxwell equations, if it's a photon that you're describing, and so on. So, I'm sorry I started too early, apparently. Or you had trouble getting out of wherever you were. Now, our problem is to describe an intermediate position. We have an idea that it's something like a particle, but we have a precise idea, which is that there's an amplitude to arrive at different places in time. Under the classical circumstances in which you expect that you know what the energy is and what the momentum is. In other words, if you had a situation where you thought that the particle should classically have a definite energy, E, and a definite momentum, P, then the quantum mechanical situation represents that by saying that the amplitude to be in different places varies this way, as E to the I omega T minus P dot E to the I, well, omega t minus k dot x. In other words, is a plane wave. A particle of known momentum and energy corresponds to an amplitude which varies as a plane wave. Now, you see immediately what I mean by an approximate description. If it was a particle, then it would have a definite energy and momentum. But it isn't a particle. It's represented as an amplitude. And so I'm comparing two ideas, and I'm trying to get the relationship between the two ideas. In that sense, this whole lecture has a certain impreciseness and a slopping back and forth between waves and particles. But the problem, the interesting question is the relationship of the frequency and the wave number. to the energy and the momentum of the particle. And if the energy is E, and then the frequency of that the amplitude varies in time omega, then E is equal to H omega, and the momentum vector is H times the wave number K. We've already pointed out that's a four-dimensional thing. We had the same remark made in the case of light as a photon, because the thing is completely general, however, and applies not only to light, but also to any particle at all with energy and momentum. According to the classical relativity, if the particle has a rest mass, m, then e squared minus p squared c squared is m squared c to the fourth. That's classical theory. The quantum mechanical equations for the amplitudes give us instead a different rule that tells us that the frequency of the waves is related to the wave number of the waves by this difference of these two squares here being a constant, and this constant we call m squared c fourth over h squared, where m is called the rest mass. So you see, this, of course, is the same equation as that with this relationship. So here's these two are the same thing with that interconnection. In particular, for the special case of a particle of zero rest mass, now, for example, light, which is a photon of zero rest mass, the m would be zero on this side. For light, you know, the wave number is related to the frequency by omega is equal to the magnitude of the wave number vector times c. That is to say, omega squared minus k squared c squared is zero, so that light is a particle of zero rest mass. Another particle, electron, obeys this law. And you can always find a frequency and the momentum if you know that it have a classical situation in which you know the energy or the momentum or expect that you have it right. If you have a particle in which you know the energy and you know its mass, it's an electron, then of course you can calculate the magnitude of the momentum. And thus, the magnitude of the K vector, and I'm sure you remember that the magnitude of the K vector is 1 over, or rather is 2 pi, over the wavelength. And so we also have that the magnitude of the momentum is Planck's constant over the wavelength. A word about notation. This little cross bar on here, h bar, means h divided by 2 pi, when the h without the bar hasn't got the 2 pi. H bar, which is h over 2 pi, is 1.054 times 10 to the minus 34 joule seconds. It's so tiny that in any reasonable sized equipment, you don't see any of the effects, of course. So that's why a classical mechanics worked for such a long time so accurately. So wave, if you knew the energy and therefore the magnitude of the momentum, you may not know the direction of the particle directly, but you still know what the wavelength is. In this case, I assumed also I knew precisely the direction of the momentum. Let me use this to analyze for you as an example of how to use this thing roughly, the situation with the two slits. Here we had a source, and then we had two slits, and then we had a wall here, and we were trying to calculate the amplitude to arrive at different places on the wall. Let's say here's a place at height x or something like that, and we have to find the amplitude to arrive there. We had a source of electrons back here. Now let me put the source of electrons at infinity here, okay? So that the thing arrives horizontally that way. So you say, oh, I know the momentum is horizontal. It's not true because we know when it goes through the slit, after it goes through the slit, it'll be diffracted as a wave, and we no longer know the momentum in this direction accurately. But we do suppose that there's no, because it's a rigid slit, that there's no change in energy, and that, therefore, we know the magnitude of the momentum. So to make a long story short, the situation is this, that you can calculate the diffraction pattern to be expected here in the same way as we did for light, but with a wavelength given by this formula here. For instance, if the distance from the first slit to this point of observation is d1, and the distance of the second slit is d2, then the amplitude to arrive is very closely, is approximately e to the i d1 over lambda plus e to the minus d2 over lambda. That's, you get equal amounts, but the phase is shifted by the total number of cycles. Wait a minute, divided by lambda cross, 2 pi d over lambda. Oh, you don't know what lambda cross is, all right. 2 pi d1 over lambda, and 2 pi d2 over lambda. These amplitudes are made equal here. There are very slight corrections for the differences in angles and so on that comes from a more accurate equation, which we'll not investigate. This is close enough. In particular, for instance, you might wish to know how far apart is the pattern, and we can do that. I have the bumps in the pattern, and we can do that the same way as we did it in the case of light. Suppose that this is a maximum, and we want to know where the next maximum is. Suppose the distance of the maxima is called A. How far apart are they? Well, this maximum occurs because the time to, the number of waves, wavelengths from here and from here are equal, so the phases are equal, so you get a maximum. The two interfere together. The next maximum will occur when they interfere together again at the new point, namely here. At this new point, the two lines look like this. And I suppose that this distance to the screen is called capital L and is relatively long. Then, and the distance between the two holes are called D. Then there'll be another maximum when there's a complete oscillation difference in the wavelength. That is, this distance is greater by one wavelength than that distance. We kept thinking in terms of time in the case of light, but since the speed was always constant, it was equivalent to think in terms of wavelengths. But now we must be very careful to think in terms of wavelengths because it's the length in the geometry that determines the situation here. Now, this then will be one wavelength. And this angle, well, you can see from the triangle, so this angle here is the angle of the deflection. And you get that A is to lambda, L is as a wavelength is to D. So it determines the spacing of the bumps. And the wavelength is determined in a given circumstance. Suppose you have 300,000 volt electrons, then you figure out what their momentum is classically. You divide that into Planck's constant, and that gives the wavelength. Yeah. Then this then will tell you the size. So you can get a quick estimates of a lot of things this way, although they're not completely accurate because we don't have all the effects that are analogous to cosines and whatnot of angles that have to do with. Well, never mind. It's only an approximation. Well, like the distance here is greater, so the intensity of this one is weakened a little bit inversely as the distance and so on. I don't have all those factors in. In fact, we can use this relationship here to analyze a few of the points that I made last time to see if they really work. First of all, we noticed that if we tried to watch the electrons with light to see which hole they went through, that we would would disturb the pattern over here by enough to move electrons which would have come to a maximum here into a minimum. And we explain that roughly by saying that the light photons which are coming this way, having a momentum piece of light, would hit the electrons which are coming through and deflect them. If lambda is the wavelength of the light, then the momentum of the light photon is h over lambda of the light. Now, how big would p light have to be in order to smear out the pattern? In order to smear out the pattern, we'd have to take an electron that should have arrived here and deflect it, say, half a wave. We'll say roughly, because I'm just doing orders of magnitude now. We have to deflect it a distance of order A at a distance L. In other words, the angle that we have to deflect the electron is of order A over L. But if the momentum of the electron in this direction is called P sub electron, capital P sub electron, which is exactly the same P as I had over here. And this is, of course, the wavelength for the electron. The reason I put all that in is because we got two different waves in the same problem. And I'll label every wave so you know which wavelength is which. Delta theta is A over lambda. So the delta of the momentum, the vertical component of the electron momentum, this way, the error produced because of the kick of the light is, of course, the electron momentum times delta theta and is equal to P sub electron times A over L. And if I use this formula here for the relation of P to wavelength, I have H over the lambda of the electron times A over L. In other words, the vertical momentum deflection needed to smear the pattern is this. The vertical deflection momentum given by the light is that. The pattern will be smeared. If P sub light exceeds this delta that you need to smear the pattern. In other words, if a P sub light is greater than H over lambda electron times A over L, but A over L is lambda electron over D. I know that already. See, A over L is lambda electron over D. So this expression here is also equal to H over D. In other words, it says that you will get a smear provided P sub light, which is incidentally H over the wavelength of the light, is greater than H over the distance between the holes. That is to say, it get a smear provided lambda of the light. You get a smear if lambda of the light is less than D. So if you use lambda is less than the spacing between the holes, the pattern will smear. So in order to avoid smearing the pattern, you have to use wavelengths of light longer than the spacing between the holes. And therefore, you can no longer tell which hole the thing comes through. That brings us then to another point. What is the resolving power of a microscope? We talked about it before. I'll just repeat the discussion. Why can't I see two things that are closer together than one wavelength of light? Now we're talking about light, looking with a microscope to see two spots. Here represents the microscope objective lens, and here it's looking at some particular spot, and this angle here is theta, the opening of the angle of the microscope, and the wavelength that's being used is lambda for light in this experiment, in this observation of the microscope. And now, how good is the resolving power? In other words, how far over here must another spot be that I can just make it out? We talked about this, and we said when we were discussing it that this thing is so built that the time of all the waves is exactly the same to arrive here, but this point must be far enough away so that the time on one route going on this side and the time on the other side must differ by a whole cycle. What amounts to the same thing is that the difference in the distance from here to here and from here to here must be one wavelength. Now let me show it to you another way. If you believe in the reciprocity idea, that the way an instrument works when you look at something is the same as it would be if you project light the other way, you might ask, suppose light came down out of this lens and were focused at that point. You know there's a diffraction pattern. The question is, how far apart's the next minimum? And the next minimum occurs when the wave that's coming out of here has one wavelength difference across from one end of the other to the other of the opening. So again, we have the same kind of analysis. So if we call this distance here A, we need to find out how much this distance plus this distance here to here minus the distance to here differs. And if it differs by lambda, then we know that's as close as we can see to object. Well, it takes a little bit of geometry to see. You draw a vertical this way, and this distance here, that one, this angle under here is theta, and this is A sine theta. But the same thing happens on the other one, only it gets shorter, and I'll let you look at the details yourself. The idea is all you need to know, but that 2A sine theta, which is the difference in it, must be equal to lambda, and that determines the smallest A that can be distinguished in a microscope. It's sometimes A is equal lambda over 2 sine theta. So it means that we must build our microscope with as wide an opening at the bottom as possible. A good microscope has the lenses very wide and very close to here so that we get a big sign. Also, the best microscopes are built, the greatest resolving power is made by a very clever trick to make lambda smaller. Well, you use ultraviolet light, yeah, and then you have to use photographs, and you can't see it. Or you put the whole thing under oil. In oil, the wavelength is shorter than in air, so if you put oil all over here, the spacing you can see is smaller. That's called an oil immersion microscope. At any rate, then, you see that the nearest thing that we can measure with a microscope is orders of magnitude, since this can't be any smaller than 2, any bigger than 2, that A has at least 2 exceed order of magnitude lambda. So you can't see 2 things that are close together closer than the wavelength of the observing light or particles, whatever you use. And so in this experiment, we wouldn't be able to see the 2 together if we used light that was longer than D. We wouldn't be able to see which place the light came from. Now, we also noted last time that there was a very ingenious way, a kind of mixture of classical and quantum ideas, but a legitimate one in this case, to determine which hole the thing went through, which was to put this on roller bearings and let the light, let's suppose the electrons come from infinity, so it's easier for me to calculate the momentum changes. The 2 particles, say, come to the screen here. The spacing is d. And the idea was that since the momentum here, say, was horizontal and now has an angular deflection, while this one has an angular deflection up, there's a difference in momentum that some afterwards the screen will be moving up or down depending upon which hole the thing went through. Now, what is the difference between the up momentum and the down momentum in this experiment? That is, of course, if you figure a little bit, it's the component. It depends on this angle, that gives you a down component, and this angle gives you an up component. The difference is the sum of these angles. I think you can see that the difference in the momentum that you get for going through hole 1 minus the momentum you get for going through hole 2, the vertical component, is d over l, that's the angle, this was l, times the momentum of the electron that's coming through horizontally. So that the difference in momentum of the screen in the 2 cases does exist, and the magnitude of it is d over l times the momentum of the electron, the horizontal momentum. That's the difference down in the 2 cases. One is up, another is down. The difference is d over l piece of electron. Now, the point is this. The question is whether the uncertainty principle, which I stated last time, is capable of explaining that the pattern is smeared. In other words, I'd like to know how, if I we would need to measure the momentum. We need to know the momentum of the screen with an accuracy less than delta p sub 1, 2 in order to be able to determine whether the screen is moving up or down afterwards. Before we do the experiment, we have to set the screen with a known momentum, with enough precision so that we can tell that this tiny difference for the 2 cases is a real is there. So we have to know, for instance, the screen was essentially at 0 momentum within some accuracy. And the momentum of the screen then must be less than this delta p, or less than this expression here. But according to the uncertainty principle, the delta p of the screen must at least, well, the uncertainty in the position of the screen, the position of the screen, times the uncertainty in the momentum of the screen must at least exceed of order of magnitude of Planck's constant. That means that the uncertainty in the position of the screen must exceed h over this delta p that I was talking about here, 1, 2, which means, of course, h over this thing, hl p sub hl over d p sub electron. Let me just get that again. The delta x, oh, yeah. Yeah. The delta x uncertainty in the vertical position of the screen, according to the uncertainty principle, must necessarily be greater than HL over, can't read it anymore, but I remember it, d p sub electron. Now, h over p sub electron is the wavelength of the electron waves. So this is the wavelength of the electron waves times L over D. But if you look over here, the wavelength of the electron waves times L over D is the spacing between the bumps. So this has the physical significance of the spacing between the bumps. And this tells us that the uncertainty principle requires that the uncertainty in the position of the screen exceed the spacing of the bumps, which is just what we want, because Each time the experiment is done, the screen is in a different place, and so we smear the pattern, but we have to at least have smeared it over the spacing between the bumps so that sometimes, because the screen's in the wrong place, this should have been a bump instead of a minimum and smears the pattern. So we have to have uncertainty of the screen greater than the spacing of the bumps, and that works also. Let's understand this, then, this rule about the uncertainty principle. It says that it should be impossible by any technique whatever to determine the position of a particle and its momentum. I should have kept that. Determine the position of anything, a screen or a particle or anything, and its momentum simultaneously with error smaller than delta P times delta X is greater than H. Actually, well, sort of magnitude, numbers don't count. I put P sub X. It turns out that all that's really required is that, in fact, all that the uncertainty principle says is that it should be impossible to determine the position of a particle in the X direction and its momentum in the X direction simultaneously with this. There's also a corresponding one for the Y direction and for the Z direction. There's also an interesting one, you know how for nature is relativistic, and for X, Y, Z, there's always T, and this one is also true, that you cannot determine the energy of a particle accurately unless you're giving yourself enough time to do it. You can't say, I know that the energy is so-and-so, and I've only had the particle such and such a length of time to observe. Say, it came out of this thing at such and such a time with such and such an energy. That's not possible. These statements, the uncertainty principle statements, are not precise statements. They're inequalities. They are merely a way of remembering where to expect classical ideas to fail. The particle ideas are, of course, not exactly right, but they're approximately right. The place where they cause trouble is when you're trying to talk about a situation in which you know at the same time the position and the momentum of a particle with an accuracy greater than that. You see, momentum is a new thing. It has something to do with the way the amplitude is changing in space or something. In X, the position, there's only a probability of finding an electron in different positions, so it doesn't have a definite position. And what it says is that the idea of a definite position and the idea of a definite momentum are not accurate. And it is merely a signpost to tell you when to watch out. If you've ever start making an argument in which you imply that you know the position and the momentum of an electron, better than that, you're making a mistake. Because this is a protector of the region in which quantum mechanics is supposed to hold. Let me give one example of how the one made by Heisenberg, an interesting one called a gamma ray microscope, but an ordinary microscope would work just as well. Suppose that this were the screen that I was talking about with the two holes in it, and I wanted to determine the position of it. How would I do it? I'd take a microscope, I'd make a little mark on the screen, and I'd say, well, now I'm going to do this experiment. I'm going to set the screen very carefully with a microscope to make sure that it's in a definite location. So we look at the scratch on the screen in the microscope. Why should there be any uncertainty in momentum? Yeah? Because in order to see it, first there's an uncertainty in position. Why? Because there's a finite resolving power of the microscope, and this is the formula for the uncertainty in the position. If lambda is the wavelength that I use of the light in this microscope. But why should there be an uncertainty in momentum? Because I'm using light from a microscope. That's why. Because the light which is coming into the microscope has hit this point, say either it came up this way and got scattered, or from the side, doesn't make any difference. Let's say it came up from the bottom and got scattered. Well, it comes up with a certain momentum. Its momentum that it's coming with is h over the lambda of the light. Now, when it comes scattered, it's scattered through an angle. So that the horizontal momentum, see, if it goes off here at an angle theta, suppose it goes to the outside edge of the lens at angle theta, then the horizontal component of the momentum is h over lambda sine theta. This momentum is recoiled. It gives a recoil to the screen. And of course, it can also be on the other side. So it gives a recoil in either direction. And the total uncertainty in the momentum of the screen will be this. And the uncertainty in the position of the screen, we have just found out, was A, which is given by 2 lambda over 2 sine theta. Now, if you multiply the uncertainty in the position by the uncertainty in the momentum, the lambda will cancel and the sine will cancel, which means you can't get away by using shorter wavelengths. That makes you get smaller delta x's. But on the other hand, because of the shorter wavelength, much more momentum in the photons and much more uncertainty in the momentum. Or you say, I know what I'll do. The trouble here is that they allow the light to go through a wide angle, so you don't know the momentum. Use a very narrow, use the lens far away and very small aperture. Then you know this vertical momentum, small angle. But under those circumstances, the resolving power of the microscope stinks. You have to have, you have a large uncertainty in position. So you see, its product is always the same. Now, the next subject I talk about is this, that since we've been talking about electrons and other particles so much as particles, I would like to discuss phenomenon which shows that the electron is a wave in a certain respect. We've already talked about one in regard to this, imaginary diffraction experiment that I talked about, but I would like to discuss a real experiment because this one is too hard to do. And the reason is that for any easy-to-handle electrons, the wavelength is very short. It's hard to make the apparatus to see such narrow wavelengths. They're of the order, let's say, for a 30-kilovolt electron. I don't know, it's of the order of an angstrom or so. I don't know offhand. I didn't figure it out. I'm not sure what. Maybe it's shorter. Anyway, yes, it is. It's about a 10th or a 20th of an angstrom for 30 kilovolts. So at any rate, the wavelengths are so small that we have to do our diffraction experiments on a very small scale. So instead of using a lot of lines and a grating that we can rule ourselves as we can for light, where the wavelength is sizable, we have to use a grating which is very much finer. And one grating which is fine, of course, is the arrangement of the atoms in a crystal. And so I would like to discuss the diffraction effects from a grating, but this time the grating is the atoms which are arranged in a crystal in a periodic fashion. Of course, this thing works just as well for light, X-rays, in fact, as it does for electrons or for any other wave. So it doesn't make any difference what wave I'm talking about. I'm talking about the diffraction from a crystal. Let's, if you want, you can imagine I'm talking about light just like I was before. Now the situation is you have a crystal like this thing here with lots of atoms arranged in a nice pattern. The question is, how can we arrange, when do we get a strong beam? We've done it already with a single line. We've calculated where we get strong beams. But the difficulty here is it's just that it's a three-dimensional grating. The answer is this, that if the light, say, is coming from infinity and is going off in a certain other direction toward infinity, we should like to arrange that all of the atoms reflect in phase, yeah? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to draw in this space all places that correspond to the same phase of reflection. I'll explain in just a minute. And then I'm going to say all the atoms have to be on those places, on those loci. See, for instance, if an atom is here, there's a certain phase of the reflection. Now, if I draw a line here, which makes equal angles with both of these, just like a regular reflection, you know that the time to go from here to here to here to here, or the distance, in fact, is equal for this point as for any other point. And so that if I take a point here, this will be shorter along the horizontal, but longer along the other line, and exactly the same amount. So that any atoms along this plane will all reflect in phase. So if I can get all the atoms on that plane, I'm all set. We know that. But there are atoms in three dimensions, so we have to be more careful. We have to worry about somewhere else. Now look, if I went to another plane further back, they would reflect in phase with this, provided, because the time is not the same now, but is longer. This distance is extra long here and extra long here compared to the other one. The extra distance from here to here is, if that's an extra wavelength, I'm all right. If the spacing of these two planes is called d, then Oh, it takes a little drawing to figure it out. Let's see. I can't figure it out right away. You figure it out. If the spacing is d and the angle here is theta, then the extra distance that this wave would have to go compared to the original one is 2d sine theta. And if this is equal to some multiple of a wavelength, any multiple of a wavelength, then these will be in phase with those. In fact, I can draw all the planes for each wavelength, and so on. Now, the idea is that we get very strong reflection if the crystal happens to be set in such a way that all the atoms lie on these planes. See, whether so that all of them will come in phase. And that's the trick. You see, the atoms are in planes, and all we have to do is arrange the planes in a certain orientation for our particular angle of detection, and then have the right wavelength so that the spacing between the planes is equal to the wavelength. The planes that you can see in this are obvious horizontal ones, but there are also a lot of other ways that you can set the thing. For example, I can set it this way, because there's a whole plane of atoms this way. The next plane is here, so if the wavelength is related to sine theta with this d, the d from here to here, I'll get another reflection. And so on. If you want to see these planes, you ride past the orange groves when they just have the sticks in, getting ready for the orange trees. And if you look in different directions, you'll see definite lines of the sticks. And those are the different angles at which there are planes. And the spacing between the planes can be determined then by looking at what angles and what wavelengths we get strong reflections. This works for x-rays, and the first slide shows what happens if you do this with rock salt with x-rays. The x-rays that were used were not monochromatic, but the salt was fixed in its position. And every time it's possible to find a set of planes which will give a reflection, there's a reflected dot. The wavelength that's reflected depends upon the spacing of the planes, and the wavelength that's reflected, all these spots would be colored if you could see them as in light, although it's the wrong wavelength, because they all correspond to different wavelengths. But you can see from the measuring the position of the various spots, we can determine the spacing of the various planes and thus the arrangement of the atoms in the crystal. The most extensive and complicated job that's ever been done was to a crystal which had, we can have the lights just a second. This is very simple because it repeats almost repeats sodium, chlorine, at least one repetition element is two atoms. But the most complicated that's ever been done is a whole mess of things, a great big glob, myoglobin. It's a kind of a, something like a hemoglobin, but in muscles, of a horse. And it's a great big complicated molecule which repeats with about 1,000 atoms. And the next picture shows the x-ray photograph which was taken of such a thing, and you see the thousands and thousands of dots, some hundred dots maybe. I'm sorry, I exaggerated there. I didn't think what I'm saying. You notice that some of the dots are bright and some of the dots are dark. And that's the way you can determine where the atoms are. If you give me the lights a moment, I'll show you why. Suppose that the one kind of atom is arranged on the planes like this, and that this is a wavelength. Now suppose another atom is arranged on plane along here. And that's a half a wavelength. If there were just as many of these and they were the same kind as that, then for the positive wave coming here, there'll be an equal negative wave coming there, and you get no reflection. If this thing is a different kind of an atom and scatters more or less strongly, there's an interference between these effects. And so some dots, some angles, they will interfere, other angles, they'll reinforce. And so you get all kinds of pluses and minuses, and by that, it's possible to determine the position of all the atoms. That alone didn't succeed with 1,000 atoms. It's too hard. A lot of chemistry was used to suggest what was near what inside. Anyway, that's the most complicated substance that has ever been analyzed. It's also possible to analyze these things for not crystalline materials, but crystals in which the crystals are in all different positions. For instance, if you have a thin foil, then each little crystallite is in a different position. And then these pictures with the nice dots are spun, so to speak, around because the crystals are in all different positions. And that's shown in the next slide. This picture here, number A, is a picture taken with X-rays through a gold foil. If the gold foil were a single crystal, there would be a series of dots that there was for the sodium chloride. But the crystal's in all orientations, and so there are circles. Now, this picture's very similar. It's also a gold foil, and this is another one, a silver foil. The difference between these two pictures and this is this was used with X-rays, which you all admit are waves, but these were done with electrons, which we have to now admit are waves. And the pattern and spacings of the rings determines the wavelength of the X-rays after you, for instance, have determined the spacing from the The spacing of these rings determines the wavelength of the electrons in the same way as it determines the wavelength of the X-rays. And so you can check whether or not this formula of de Broglie connecting the wavelength and the momentum is right. Of course, it's right, or I wouldn't waste my time telling you about it. Lights, please. That, then, is a demonstration that electrons act as particles, waves. Now let's take the opposite. What is the evidence that photons act as particles? What are the effects, rather, some of the effects of photons acting as particles? The most striking effect, the simplest to understand, is the so-called photoelectric effect. If light is very weak and shines on a metal surface and carries a frequency omega and is weak enough, it should come in pulses. And therefore, it should kick out electrons. This is the way that the photons were most definitely established, in fact, historically. We'll kick out electrons, but the energy of the photon will be given to the electron. Therefore, the energy of an electron would be equal to Planck's constant times the frequency of the photon. And that's the photoelectric equation. In practice, however, the electrons which you observe, you don't see their total energy because, first of all, they're created inside the material. They have to escape through the walls and so on. This is the kinetic energy given to the electron, but it's bound in here and has to come out through the surface and so on. So you'll often see that the kinetic energy of the electron is equal to Planck's constant minus some constant, which has to do with the difficulty of getting out of the metal surface. But that's a technical matter. The main idea is that the energy of the photon is directly delivered to that of the electron, and you can see the electrons coming out with those energies, and it works, in fact, very well. Now let me show you another phenomenon, which is the most beautiful, the most complete demonstration of the absolute particle nature of light, and that's the effect called the Compton effect. If I have an electron and I have a wave of light coming on it with frequency omega, we've already discussed how the light should be regenerated or rescattered. As the atom oscillates in response to the electric field and thus generates a new field, and naturally, obviously, indefinitely, the new field has the same frequency as the oscillation of the atom, therefore the same frequency as the light that's coming in. So the scattered light has the same frequency as the light that's coming in. But Compton observed with X-rays scattering from electrons that is sufficiently highly energetic light that it wasn't true that the frequency of the light that comes out is lower than the frequency that went in. And that, of course, is a complete defeat of the classical theory. But it's very easy to understand a la particles. Suppose that we realize that this thing has a certain energy, H omega, and a momentum, H omega over C. If I let the speed of light be one in the equations, I can simplify everything, but I can. Now, if this thing hits that, and we can think of it as a particle hitting another particle in a collision, then after the ball is over, the electron is recoiling in this direction with a certain momentum whose magnitude is P and the energy E, and a photon comes off at another angle, say theta, with a new frequency omega prime, and, of course, a new momentum H omega prime over C. The new frequency is lower than the original frequency for the obvious reason that the electron having a recoil has energy, takes away energy. And so there's less energy than there was before. So the photon, which had an energy H omega which came in, must now have a lower energy H omega prime. I let you figure out the right equations, and I just wrote them down to show you they're not to give you some idea, but it's better for you to try it for yourself. However, I'll only show you how one works, and the others should be clear after that. First, the vertical component of momentum after the collision must be the same as before the collision. Before the collision, it's zero. That means that the vertical component of the electron momentum here, which I've drawn down, P sine theta, must be equal to the momentum of the photon, which is h omega prime over c, times sine theta, p sine phi, well, h omega prime sine theta, and so on. And finally, if you got all these things, you must realize that the energy of an electron and its momentum are related together, because the electron has a definite mass. And when you put these four equations together judiciously, you'll determine exactly how much the frequency should shift, just as Compton did and as it is found experimentally. If the photon is a particle, can be represented in some sense as a particle with energy and momentum, one question still remains. One characteristic of a photon is its polarization. From the point of view of particle, photon as a particle, what the hell is the polarization? And let me tell you what it is this way. That I take right-hand circularly polarized light in the definition that I'm talking about. The light is going down onto the blackboard. This is the x-axis and the y-axis. And the electric field, say, is here and is going around this way. Now, this electric field drives, say, an atom. There's an atom and the light is shining on it, and the atom is driven up and down. You can figure it out for that case, but it's easier to figure a case in which the electron in the atom can go both ways, up and down or sideways. Under those circumstances, the electron will oscillate horizontally and vertically with equal amplitude at equal frequencies, 90 degrees out of phase, just like the x and y of the light. And the net result is that the electron's motion is also a circle. If this is the displacement of the electron at distance a at any time, it goes around in a circle too. So first we calculate the rate of work. If the electric field is this way and the displacement is that way, then this electric field, then the work is just a tangential component of the electric field times the charge times the velocity. Well, this is all going around at angular velocity omega, so the velocity of the electron is a omega, and this is equal to the work per second, or the energy delivered to the charge per second. Now, the first part of this, QE tangential A, is the torque which is developed by the light. And therefore, this is the torque, or the angular momentum, delivered to the charge per second. This goes on all the time. As the charge absorbs energy, it absorbs angular momentum in the same ratio, namely 1 over omega. And therefore, the angular you can describe all this by saying that light carries an angular momentum which is equal to the energy divided by omega. So a right-hand circularly polarized light carries angular momentum equal to the energy over omega. Or for a photon particle, that's h omega over omega, or just h. Just a second while I make one remark. If light has a momentum and goes by over here, of course it has an angular momentum, because it's got an angular momentum around this axis. But we're talking about a different kind. If the light is going right at a wall, it twists the wall this way. So it's an intrinsic angular momentum. As the light comes at your eye, it twists the eyeball. Now, if it's right-hand circularly polarized, and each photon carries an angular momentum in the longer direction of motion, h. And therefore, you could say that light is represented by a spinning particle. It's a particle that's going along and spinning as it goes along, if you want a classical particle picture of light. And the polarization, right-hand circular, corresponds to spinning to the right with angular momentum h. Left-hand circular corresponds to spinning to the left with angular momentum h, or in other words, spinning to the right with angular momentum minus h. So the angular momentum in the one direction of motion is either plus or minus h, and thus is the particle picture of light completed by saying that it's not just a particle, but a spinning particle. And the amount of the spin is 1 unit of h, and we say that the spin is 1 then, because the unit of h cross is common to all angular momenta. So light is a spin 1 particle. What about the plane polarized light? You know that plane polarized light, and I emphasize that light in the x direction can be represented as 1 over the square root of 2 of right-hand circular plus 1 over the square root of 2 of left-hand circular. In the quantum theory, then, plane polarized light is described as light, which has an amplitude 1 over the square root of 2 to be right-hand circular, and an amplitude 1 over the square root of 2 to be left-hand circular. So the probability that you'll find it right circular, if you measure the angular momentum, is 1/2, and the left circular is 1/2. So the average angular momentum of a mass of these, for mass of these photons is 0, some plus, some minus, 50-50. But the polarization is represented by giving the amplitudes of the two other kinds. Light polarized in the y direction turned out to be 1 over the square root of 2 and minus 1 over the square root of 2, I believe, right-hand circular and left-hand circular. Or maybe it's I there, I forget. No, I guess it's the way I say. No, it's I. 90 degrees out of phase. This also has equal probability of being right and left. But physically, it's very different because of the possible interference effects between the two amplitudes, the subtlety of quantum mechanics. So the polarization of light is an interesting complication. The x and y polarizations are not polarizations of a definite angular momentum, but only 50-50. In order to have a definite angular momentum, you have to have either right or left circularly polarized light. Now finally, there's one more item that I'd like to explain that the quantum mechanics ideas help to understand, and that is the whole existence of atoms at all. According to the observations of Rutherford, in an atom, there's a central charge, the proton. Say in a hydrogen atom, let's take a proton, or any other nucleus with a plus charge around which electrons are supposed to go if you believe in particles. But that ain't possible, because as the electron goes around a proton, it's accelerating. An accelerating electron radiates light. So it loses energy, and it loses energy, and it coasts down and stops. Where? Right on top of the proton, and the atom would be here with the electron right in the middle, having no size at all to speak of. And furthermore, the spectrum which would be emitted by the hydrogen would be a continuous spectrum, because as it went in, it would go faster and faster, and the frequency of light could be anything at all. But if you look at a hydrogen, you find definite frequencies. So this whole model is wrong. The atom will collapse. But this is impossible, according to quantum mechanics. And why? Suppose that you knew that the electron were right here in the middle of the proton, standing still. That's against the uncertainty principle. You know where it is, at the center of the proton, and you know how fast it's moving. Namely, it isn't moving at all. It's standing there in the middle of the proton. That's not possible. There's a minimum amount of motion that an object can have, according to quantum mechanics. At the lowest temperature of absolute zero, things still are not located exactly. And in this particular case, in the lowest state of the hydrogen atom, the electron is not sitting right at the proton, because then you'd know too much about it. In fact, I get a very rough estimate about where it sits, if you let me make a very crude analysis of this thing. Suppose that we say that the electron is uncertain, that if we looked at it, we'll have different probabilities of finding it in different places, and then it's spread over a range of the order A. Then the average, you see, why shouldn't it come in closer? It's got lower energy if it comes in closer. The attraction means that the energy is minus the charge on the electron squared over 4 pi epsilon naught A, which I prefer to write in the form E squared over A. That's a potential energy, a negative energy. And the smaller I make A, the lower the energy, the nearer it wants to get to the proton. On the other hand, when it gets within a spacing A, the momentum that it has, it can't be standing still. It has to have an uncertain momentum, must be at least bigger than Planck's constant over A. And therefore, the kinetic energy, which it'd have to have because it's got this momentum, is of order momentum squared over twice the mass of the electron, which is h squared over 2ma squared. So the idea is that if we take the total energy, the kinetic energy, plus the potential energy, it depends upon how closely we hold the electron. If we let the electron spread over a big distance, then we have to have hardly any momentum because of the quantum mechanics, and no much kinetic energy, but the electron is attracted by the proton. It tries to come in. It's better for it to come in. But if it comes in too far, then you have a very high momentum. So that this is an expression for the energy for different degrees of spread And it looks something like, well, it's like this. When you're out here, you get negative energy, keep coming in, but if you're going too far, you got to watch out because you're confining the electron too much and you need to give it too much momentum and therefore too much kinetic energy. If you will figure out when this expression is a minimum by methods due in the calculus, you will discover that this is a minimum when the size A is equal to h squared over me squared, and that the minimum energy, the energy that the electron has at the minimum condition, is minus e squared over 2a naught. And if you put in the numbers, you'll find that this corresponds to 5.528 angstroms, or 10 to the minus 10th meters, which is just about the size of atoms, and that this corresponds to minus 13.6 electron volts, which is the energy that you need to give an electron in order to get it out of a hydrogen atom. Now, this argument that I made here has all kinds of orders of magnitude in it. I said e squared over a, but that's an order of magnitude. Sometimes it's closer, sometimes further. There should be some numerical constant in here. And I say p is of the order h over a. I can't really believe in this 2 and so forth. So this is just orders of magnitude. Actually, I've cheated you. I put the constants in just where I wanted them. I put h crosses in the right places and 2s in the right places. So this does come out the mean square, the mean radius of the hydrogen atom, and this does come out the actual energy of binding of hydrogen. But we had no right to believe that. Thank you.
Say I have a photograph like that, different intensities and all of that, and I don't know exactly what the crystal was. I just know
right.
It's a square crystal, cubic crystal.
Yeah. Well, you can tell it's cubic from looking at the spot.
That's it. I can tell from looking at the spots where they are and how bright they are.
Yeah. But just first that it's cubic, you can tell by the arrangement of the spots. In fact, in the case of sodium chloride, you saw a sort of square arrangement.
Right.
That's because with the crystal set up this way, say?
Light coming in.
Say, from light coming in this way, would have planes. You see, if there's a plane in this direction to reflect, then there's also a plane in this direction to reflect. So if there's a spot over there, there's a spot over there.
Right.
If it's a different arrangement, like hexagonal or something, then their patterns are different. And so from the arrangement of the dots, you can also obtain where the planes are, and therefore what the symmetry of the crystal is.
To analyze the dots,
and the brightness of the dots tells you the position of different kinds of atoms in one repetitious unit. That's called a unit cell. Any crystal can be represented as some unit which repeats. So there are two aspects. The repetition pattern is a cubic or what? And what's in a unit? What unit is repeated? Something like wallpaper. You have pictures of parrots. And they're repeated in a certain pattern. But what is repeated is a pattern. Now, the pattern of repetition is the pattern of the dots. That you don't need to measure any intensities for. But what it is that's making the shape of the pattern, you know, the arrangement of the atoms in the cell, that is determined by the relative intensity.
So that if I wanted to go about analyzing this picture that somebody handed me, I'd say, well, now let's see, if I had a cubic structure with such and such a cell, I predict it would look like this. No, it isn't that, so let's see if I had another cell.
That's the best way to do it, yes. That's the way it's done.
And chemistry would say, well, you have so much oxygen and so much nitrogen.
That helps you to decrease the number of trials, yes. It gives you good clues. And, of course, the further along you get, the more you know about what to guess.
What do you do with an alpha helix or something like that?
You guess an alpha helix with arbitrary places. Actually, it turns out there is a way to figure out backwards, provided I could measure not the intensity of each dot, but the amplitude of each dot. The amplitude of the wave. Yes, see, the difference is the phase.
Right.
the phase. I don't measure the phase. If I could measure the phase, you can show, interestingly enough, that you can reverse the whole thing mathematically exactly and figure out precisely what the arrangement of the atoms would be by a direct process. The only trouble is you don't have the phase. And the way that this terrible alpha helix job was done was by getting the phase this way. If in each unit cell you'd add another atom that was very heavy, say, if you could stick one in a known place, then the intensities would all change because they would be interfering what they used to be what they were before, plus an interference with the new one.
Right.
But you know what the new one is, and by the direction of the interference, you can determine the phase. And so the phases were determined, and then the reverse process is unique. But that's the only time it's ever been done that way. Most crystals in the beginning were done the way you say. You took a good guess as to what the arrangement was, you tried a number of guesses, and then all of a sudden one fit on the nose, and that was it. And you kept on going, accumulating, but those were for simple things like this. But you're quite right, you can never get 1,000 atoms by trial and error. So the method was to put in substitution atom and obtain the shifts in the intensities and thus determine the phases and then reverse the thing directly. It's possible to reverse directly if you have the phases.
How would you put in substitution atom in some, well, Dr. Pauling gave us a lecture on hemoglobin or something.
That's what this
put
is.
In a heavier,
that's what it was put
isotope?
In. Well, they put in, now what the hell did they put in? I forget what atoms, they were able to, cesium or something they put in. I forget what the atom was that they were able to add to the thing. I think there's some place on the complicated molecule that's an acidic group, a negative charge, that usually has a proton near there. Well, you put a sodium,
oh,
a potassium, a cesium.
It's not just changing one of the atoms that's already there, then? It's
no,
putting another
it's
one
putting
in.
Another one on top somewhere. I think that's the way it's. I'm not exactly sure, but it's. I think that's the way
it's. Like it should be.
Did you go to this seminar Wednesday, the chemistry seminar?
No, what was it about?
Well, they had a guy there on campus who had something like 1,200 atoms in the inner cell.
That was this thing.
NICD2.
What was the name of the stuff?
NICD2.
Oh, God. NICD2 has 1,000 atoms in a unit cell. I'll be darned. And how did he ever get that figured out?
He didn't tell us. He told us what it looked like. And that was bad enough. It has these little, these chopped off tetrahedrons. You know, the ends are chopped off and it has a big atom inside instead of the inside. And there are about 37 of these things stuck together.
That's amazing. I used to be quite impressed by a thing that had 52 atoms in a unit cell in certain alloys. There's a whole set of alloys that all do the same thing, and it's some complicated set of 52. This is much wilder. I had never heard of it.
It's really amazing.
Yeah, but that's quite difficult to analyze those things when there are that many atoms.
Do you recommend any book on this stuff?
Yeah, there's a lot of books. You look a book, you know, the atoms, molecules, or... there's a book called Modern Physics, the Introduction to Modern Physics by Rick Meyer and Kennard, for instance.
Rick,
yeah, that's a pretty good book.
How do you spell that?
RICHT MEYER and Kennard, KENNARD. But look under Lauritsen instead, Tommy Lauritsen. The most recent edition has his name in it, too, because he rewrote it, you see. So if you look under Lauritsen, you'll probably find the best one.
Did you find him?
I'm sorry, he was just ahead of me.
You're talking about this change, the change in momentum of the electron. By
yes.
You said this is shifted distance A. And then you plug back in from this formula over here whenever you gave this distance A.
Yeah.
You said they were the same thing. Yet when you drew this, you know, when you smeared
yes.
it, you shifted it over from a max to a min.
Yes, right. And so you must move it a distance A from a max
yeah.
to a min.
Okay.
And that's the, we worked out what A was.
This, oh, this is just for
distance
for the first,
from a max
for,
to a min. Yeah.
Max
to max, actually.
Okay.
The factors of two and stuff are not in this.
Oh, you just, oh,
yeah.
I see.
That's all right. Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay.
The nuclear reactions, they write this in the,
mm-hmm.
in all of them, there's conservation of angular momentum, which you assign these certain spins. And this would imply that the photons, when they're emitted, have certain polarizations.
That's right.
And is this true?
That's right.
Are they all circularly polarized when they come off?
Well, not everything is quite so simple. Let me give you an example of this for you, to show you. Let me just take this one example, all right? Sigma naught goes to lambda naught plus a photon. Now, the sigma naught has a spin of 1/2, and the lambda has 1/2. Now, the sigma could have been, say, spinning up with plus 1/2.
Right.
When the lambda comes off, after you see it's all over, then there's a lambda here. It could be, for instance, spinning down with a half upside down, and then the photon would coming this way would be right circularly polarized, or coming this way would be left circularly polarized. You understand? Mm-hmm. And coming this way would have equal amplitudes for being the two and would be horizontally polarized or something, and you have all different combinations. But the method of analysis is fundamentally what you think. Yes, it's polarized, but you have other cases that if you have there's also complications that there can be angular momentum, orbital angular momentum taken out. I tried to emphasize that light has another kind of angular momentum. If it goes by over here, it's got angular momentum. So that this could come out of what they call P waves, for instance. That it comes out, it's as though it were coming out at the outside edge. And so has a little angular momentum of another kind. See? So you have to add those together. So it is angular momentum is a vector. Mm-hmm. It must be added as a vector. And right. But what to do when it's quantized? What is a quantized vector? That you'll have to learn in quantum mechanics.
Can you have
But the idea is right, what you say.
Can you have one particle, the initial particle like that, and then have the lambda come off like that, and then serve it with the light?
That's right, yes. That's the way you do it, yes. Yes, that's right. That's the way it works. But they're kind of vectors, but they're not exactly like vectors because it's quantum mechanical, but very much like vectors.
Dr. Feynman, I have a little trouble understanding this.
Yeah, because I didn't...
That sine theta is in the denominator.
All right, let's just see. I didn't work it out. I forgot to plan that one. Let's just draw a picture and see if we can figure it out. Here it comes. Now, here it's coming out. They should be equal angles, so we better make them that way. The better the diagram, the easier it is to understand. Okay, now we have another plane back here. And it goes to the back. I guess the best way would be to imagine it's too close to 45 is where the trouble is. Now, let's see. It goes here and comes out. Right now, we need to find, if I draw a right angle across here, then I have this distance minus that. That's a complicated way of doing it. Let me try another easier way. Let's compare this ray to the ray which is reflected from the point right behind it. Ah, now I'm getting somewhere. There's another ray that's reflected right... Ah, we got it now. Yeah, that's what I should have drawn. Okay? Now, this distance is d, and if you draw a right angle here, then this distance is... This is theta still, isn't it? So this is d sine theta. And the extra time on the other leg is the same. So the total extra distance is 2d sine theta, and that must be some multiple of lambda. All right?
Dr. Feynman, I didn't quite follow what this represents up here, 1 over the square root.
Well, no, you're not supposed to follow that too well because it's a high-class, modern, you know, quantum mechanical thing. Suppose that you had x-polarized light and you asked me, what's that? I was answering a question you didn't ask. I told you what right circularly polarized was. It was a particle with plus angular momentum. Left was with minus. But suppose you've got a system in which you prepared a photon which has X polarization. That's neither right nor left. That's in the X direction. What the hell is that? And the answer is this, that X polarization, we noticed when we were drawing pictures, could be represented as a composition, a superposition of right circularly polarized light and left circularly polarized light with equal amounts. The square root of 2 is just, yeah, it'd come out right. No, that if you added these exactly, it would exactly be one unit of x. So it turns out in quantum mechanics, the same thing is true. You must look at it as being right circularly polarized and left circularly polarized with amplitude. Now, this is the quantum mechanic with probability amplitude 1 over the square root of 2. And with probability amplitude to be left circularly polarized, 1 over the square root of 2. That means that the probability to be right circularly polarized is 1/2. And the probability to be left circularly polarized is 1/2. But it's now, I went on, if I may, I didn't do this very well. I was talking too damn fast. I have to, this lecture will, next year will be split into two. But you can also, if you're talking, this was X polarization, it's Y polarization. Well, it comes out like this from the classical theory, and it's also in the quantum theory. You say, what's the difference between X polarization and Y polarization? Because they do different things. If you measure whether they're right or left circular polarized, there's no apparent difference. You get 50% of the photons come in right and 50% come in left. But if instead you measured, say, with Polaroid or something, you're measuring something else, and you get interference between these two cases, which is a different, and the interference in here is at a different phase in the quantum mechanics. Just like with the two holes, if you don't try to ask me which hole it is it right or is it left, but ask a different question, does it arrive here? Then you get interference effects. And so you get interference effects. X and Y polarization are interference effects between right and left circularly polarized light. Very sloppy job. Next time I must put in two lectures. Too much stuff for one lecture. Well, you know it too well. You see, it's easy, and I know it too well, and the problem is to explain it very carefully. No, to explain very carefully what you mean by adding the amplitudes and... No, that was, okay, that was bad.
One suggestion and a question.
Yeah.
I had the idea that this uncertainty principle, it would have come out very nicely if you had just said, well, now we can do it with the screen, and let's calculate under what conditions you can sort of derive the uncertainty principle, because it wasn't sort of quite clear which was...
Either way.
The question I had was, I seem to remember having seen something